Hi friends, just a reminder that neither Jody nor I are physicians and none of the following should be considered medical advice. Also, in this rapidly developing situation, the best source of information on your community and the regulations and recommendations that apply is your local health department. If you're listening to this in the future, first of all, congratulations on being in the future. Second of all, just know that the beginning of 2020 was a complicated time. Now, please enjoy the theme song by Jonathan Colton. DNA, you're in my heart. DNA. Hi, and welcome to episode 6 of BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist. I'm Andy Walsh, and I'm joined as always by my wife, Jody.
Hi.
And we're back talking about biology and the biology of the diseases we're dealing with right now and everything else that's going on.
So we're going to talk about chickenpox, right?
Oh, would that it were that simple. We could talk about chickenpox, but unfortunately we're still dealing with COVID-19 and the SARS coronavirus 2 that causes it.
Week 7 of social distancing.
Yep, for us here in Western Pennsylvania, we're at 7 weeks of staying home. Starting to talk about when that might end, but nobody has a definite timeline, and that's unfortunately understandable, an understandable reality where we are right now.
So the last time we talked about a little bit, we got into how your immune system responds to things and how it learns and how it protects us and, you know, but there's still like, I still had questions about, well, how do we make our immune systems better apart from getting sick and, you know, getting vaccines? You know, those are, you know, otherwise, are there like foods that we can eat, vitamin C? There's a story about how when this first started, like, grocery stores ran out of orange juice because everybody bought orange juice. Is that helpful?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So there's a lot there. You know, on the one hand, vitamin supplements and mineral supplements and understanding all of that is one of the great public health success stories of the 20th century. There were a number of illnesses and diseases that were the result of malnutrition, and there are people still that are experiencing, you know, malnutrition and have health consequences as a result of that. And adding things like iodine to our salt and adding things like vitamin A to our diets and supplementing breakfast cereals and things like that with vitamins to make sure that people are getting all the vitamins and minerals that they need have had, you know, clear public health benefits that, you know, probably a lot of us in the United States don't even appreciate anymore because we don't really remember. We don't have direct experience or evidence of what it was like without them and how certain conditions were common before them. And everybody knows, or lots of people are familiar with the idea of scurvy being a vitamin C deficiency, and that
our four-year-old son, or no, he was older than that. He was like 7, telling us that he thought he had scurvy because he was losing his teeth.
Right. Turned out to be just, you know, the normal, that's when you lose your baby teeth situation. But yeah, he was concerned about scurvy and, you know, the idea that British sailors were called limeys because they carried limes with them to prevent scurvy and all those sorts of things are part of popular lore. And so, you know, it's easy to make that connection between vitamins and good health and understand that vitamins are a good thing for us. And they absolutely are. There is also an upper limit to how much benefit you can get from them. Most of us are getting most of the vitamins and minerals that we need. Most of us in the United States who have access to a well-rounded diet are getting the vitamins and minerals that we need from our diet. And so the marginal benefits of adding things like a big dose of vitamin C are small. There is some data that shows that, for example, if you take vitamin C during a common cold, that it might shorten the duration of that. One estimate I saw was about 8%, which probably means like about a day in the cold. And I've seen that, you know, put on marketing of different supplements and so forth. And, and that seems to be a real number. Right. So there's some small benefit in terms of decreasing the duration of the infection. But that's not the same as curing it or preventing it in the first place. So there's little reason to think that a large dose of vitamin C is going to prevent you from getting the coronavirus, or that it's going to completely reduce your risk of the more serious consequences. But, you know, in moderation, it's not going to hurt, right? It is possible to get too much vitamin C. And so obviously pay attention to the dosing instructions on them. And obviously, you know, some people have more specific needs. And so obviously consult your physician about your specific dietary needs. That may be, there may be certain genetic factors or things that you know, people have that require more specific attention. But generally speaking, you know, taking the recommended dose of a vitamin C tablet or any kind of, you know, vitamin is not going to hurt you. And in some cases may have, you know, some small benefits.
But, you know, having a glass of orange juice for breakfast every morning is not going to keep you from getting this virus.
Right. It's not going to be the cure-all or the magic prevention for anything. But yeah, it's not necessarily a problem either. But certainly also, you know, don't buy it all. Make sure you save some for other people.
But it is scary because there are a lot of people, there are a lot of, you know, companies that kind of look at, you know, the situation that we're in and look to try and take advantage of people's fears and, you know, people feeling helpless. And so it's good to make sure that you are, you know, reading up on, you know, CDC's guidelines, and, you know, listening to doctors and scientists and getting your information that way and not necessarily buying into whatever fads that might crop up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a reality of the world that we live in that people are going to take advantage of the uncertainty and the desperate that people feel right now, and that's, you know, that's a real thing that people are going through, and I don't want to minimize that or make light of that. Certainly, people are looking for answers, and we don't have all the answers. We don't have a cure. We don't have a prevention that will completely save you from getting the coronavirus. There are certain things that we can do to reduce risk, like you know, avoiding large groups of people, like wearing masks to reduce the risk of giving it to other people. And, you know, certainly taking care of our health and well-being. You know, our immune system is part of our bodies, and the better our bodies are functioning, the better our immune system will function. So, yeah, making sure that you are getting a good diet so that you are getting all those vitamins and minerals that you need, making sure that you're getting exercise, making sure that you're taking care of your mental health. All those things are positive. You know, they're not, you know, there's an upper limit to how much good they can do, right? They're not going to, if you just keep doing more exercise, the more exercise you do, the less likely you are to get the virus. That's not the case. But there is an effect of if you don't do any exercise, if your body is really, you know, run down, you are increasing your risk. So there is a relationship there, just not a completely linear one that goes off indefinitely that you can just get more and more benefit
from. It's a system. It's a system, whereas there are different components, and if you're, you know, keeping, you know, a variety of components in good form, you know, just think of it, I think of it as like elementary school science, where we talked about ecosystems and how you need the different animals that then indicate whether a whole space is healthy or not. So kind of similar. You need the exercising, you need the diet, you need the mental health, you need all of this stuff works together to create better outcomes for a lot of things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there are multiple factors that are important for good health, and there are lots of ways to be in poor health or to reduce your health. But the flip side doesn't always, you know, that's really the main point, is that the flip side doesn't work indefinitely either. That there is sort of an enough is enough point that you can reach as well.
So with our immune systems, I can't remember if I brought this up last time or didn't quite get there, but talking about like blood types, and I think we did start talking a little bit about that. How does that kind of?
Yeah. So you asked about organ transplants. We started talking about organ transplants a little bit. You asked about blood typing, and I said we would get back to that, and we didn't. But yeah. So it turns out that blood typing has to do with your immune system as well. So there are proteins on the outside of your red blood cells that that your immune system, if they're part of your red blood cells, your immune system recognizes, understands that they're part of yourself, and so doesn't recognize them and doesn't attack them. And that's all part of the, we talked last time about how your immune system, part of what it has to do is train itself not to attack or respond to the proteins that your own body makes. And so the T cells and also the B cells that do that get eliminated early on before they get released into the bloodstream. And so if you have, for example, type A blood, then your red blood cells have the A protein, the A version of the protein on the outside of them. And so your body doesn't make antibodies to react to that A version of the protein. And there's an A version of the protein and there's a B version of the protein. And they're just, you know, it's what they call different alleles or different variants of the same gene. And they're just called A and B for simplicity. And so you can have either, or because you have a gene from your mom and a gene from your dad, you can have both. If mom and dad had different blood types, so you can have both A and B proteins, and that's AB blood type. Or you can have neither of them, and that's the O type. So O is not a type of another variant of the protein. O is the absence of that protein. And so if you are type A and you get a blood transfusion that's type B, your body won't know that that B version of the protein is a normal human protein, and it will recognize that it won't understand that that's part of your own body, so it will recognize it as foreign and respond to it. The first time that happens might not be a problem, right, because of that adaptive immunity takes a little while to ramp up. But definitely, yeah, there is a possibility for a reaction, and there's even more of a possibility if that were to happen again and again. And because there's also a second protein called the Rh factor, and that's what the plus and the minus is for. So if you're Rh plus or just plus, that means you have that protein, and if you're minus and you don't have that protein. So it's basically two different proteins. One comes in an A and a B variant, and the other just is you have it or you don't. And those determine which blood types you can receive and which blood types you can donate to. So if you are O negative, that means you don't have either protein on your red blood cells. That means you can give blood to anybody because their immune system there's no proteins for their immune systems to react to. And so that's why they're considered the universal donor. Less commonly known or less commonly talked about is that AB positive people are universal recipients. They can get anybody's blood and be okay because their body recognizes both the A version of the protein and the B version of that protein and the Rh factor as part of themselves, and they won't respond even if they get A type or B type or O type, whatever it is that they get, they won't respond. And the other thing that comes up with blood type and blood matching is in pregnancy. If mom is Rh negative and the baby is Rh positive, mom can have an immune reaction to the baby's blood. And in particular, it tends to be more of a problem for a second child. So the first child, the immune system kind of sees that Rh protein and kind of starts to react to it. And then the second time it reacts that much more quickly and more strongly if there's a second child that's also Rh positive. So that's something that doctors will keep an eye on if it's relevant to your pregnancy.
Now with blood, you know, I'm hearing one of the things that they're talking about with the virus is one of the possible treatments is the plasma donations. How does that factor in? And is type part of that or?
Right. So blood typing, as far as I know, is not part of that because plasma is just the liquid portion of the blood. So they have removed all of the cells. So they're may not be 100% perfect, but generally speaking, there shouldn't be any cell material there shouldn't be any cells in a plasma donation. And so those red blood cell proteins won't be there for the recipient to have an immune reaction to. What they are getting, though, if in that plasma is antibodies. So if somebody has had an infection like the coronavirus infection, and they have cleared it, but their immune system has recognized and responded to it, their immune system has gone through that process we talked about last time of evolving an antibody that matches very closely to that virus. And in order to help clear the virus, your body actually, the B cells secrete the antibody protein so that it's circulating in your blood, so that it's separate from the cells in your bloodstream. And so that's why those antibodies are in the plasma, even though there are no cells in the plasma. And those antibodies, then you can give to somebody else, and they can bind to the virus in that second person's bloodstream and other tissues and places, and then prevent the virus from binding with the receptor that it needs to bind to and prevent it from getting into that person's cells. And so that's a way to either help, you know, limit the severity of the infection or prevent an infection if you get it early enough. You know, at this point, you know, we're talking about using that as a treatment for more severe patients to kind of help them when their own immune system isn't quite able to keep up with the growth of the virus at some point, trying to help them out with a plasma donation from somebody who has made the antibodies. I'm not sure exactly what determines. Some people can have reactions to plasma because it is a protein, and so it is possible for your immune response to act to that as well. Generally, I would expect that it wouldn't, because there's sort of two ends to the antibody. There's the end that binds specifically to the thing like the virus that it's trying to target, and then there's the other end that is originally attached to the B cell, and if it's secreted, it might act as a sort of flag to say this is something that needs to be digested and gotten rid of. And that part is more universal. And so I would think that between many people, it would be similar enough that your body would recognize it as part of its own protein makeup rather than something foreign. There are cases, we sometimes give serum that's been made by other animals as a treatment for certain kinds of things. I believe when I was looking a little bit more, as we talked about last time, that sometimes serum is used to treat rabies. I think we've moved away from that some. I think that's not as common, but it is still an option, and it was something that I think was done more in the past. And when I was looking up those specific treatments, at least some that were used in the past were antibodies against rabies made by other kinds of animals, not humans, just because it's easier to get large quantities of them from other animals. And so it is possible to have an immune reaction to those antibodies because they're, you know, horse proteins or other kind of animal proteins that your body says, well, wait a minute, this doesn't belong here either. And so that's why, I think that's one of the reasons why we moved away from that as a treatment of rabies. It's also an issue, for example, we sometimes use serums to treat venom, it's different snake and spider bites. That's one way to deal with that. And again, sometimes you can get sick from the plasma or the serum injection because your body then reacts to those antibodies.
So then with the antibodies in your blood system, is there, for getting the plasma to help COVID-19 patients, is there like a time frame where we need to get the most these antibodies from this person to another person right away, or is your body constantly having these antibodies in your system, you know, so that there isn't that kind of, you know, rush?
Yeah, no, there's definitely a timing consideration. So it takes a little while, because it is an adaptive process, it takes a little while for your body to make those very specific antibodies that target the virus really tightly and really specifically. You're talking about a time frame of like a week, potentially. And so certainly if before that has happened, that's where you can get benefit from getting somebody else's antibodies that's already gone through that process. That may also be, you know, that the first week, though, may be that time when you're less likely to know that you have the infection. So that's one of the tricks, is figuring out as early as possible when people are infected and if they need that treatment. And most people won't need that extra help because their own immune system will get it. So that's where I think that, to start with, looking at using that as a treatment for more severely ill people who look like maybe their own immune system hasn't been able to ramp up to deal with the infection. But yeah, certainly that, you know, with any of these things, the earlier you can stop the infection, the better off you'll be, the better the outcome is likely to be, because it's an exponential growth. Just like the earlier that we started staying home to limit the infection in the population, the more benefit you reap from that, because you're stopping the exponential growth earlier and earlier in the process. The earlier you can stop the exponential growth of the virus, exponential spread of the virus in your own body, the more benefit you can get from that.
So then we were going to talk about, so specifically with, we've gone over the immune system in general, like specifically with this disease, what is going on? We know the symptoms are the fever and the cough, but like it seems to go from a fever and a cough to can't breathe. That's a pretty, you know, big leap.
Yeah, so there is a wide range of experiences with this virus, going from never knowing that you were ever infected at all and just finding out from testing that you had the virus, or that you have antibodies against the virus, which implies an exposure at some point in the past, needing help breathing, and you know, even among people who eventually get better, right, needing help breathing with a mechanical ventilator, and needing other forms of medical intervention, and then obviously there are people who are dying from it. So that is a wide range of experiences, and some of that can be explained in terms of different underlying health to start with. You know, some patients who are already in poorer health will have worse outcomes, but that's not the full story. And we're still trying to understand what exactly this virus does to your body. The receptor that it binds to, the ACE2 receptor, is expressed in a variety of different cells. I think we talked a few weeks ago, I might have given the impression that it was mostly in the lungs. That is definitely one place where it's expressed, but other cells express it in as well. And so that means that there are different cell types that are potentially able to be infected. At the same time, the virus has to get there in the first place. So the virus is coming from outside of your body, obviously. And the first place it's getting into is your nose and your respiratory tract. And so we know that it can infect the cells in your nose. We know that it can infect the cells in your lungs. But it's technically still on the outside of you, even though you think of your lungs as sort of being kept inside of you. The air in your lungs is still part of the outside. It's connected to the outside world. And so that outer surface of those cells is sort of considered on the outside, just like the outside of your skin is. They are living cells as opposed to the dead cells of your skin. That's why they can be infected, but they're still sort of that outer layer. They're not directly, there's no direct communication to your bloodstream. So even though things like there are parts of in the kidney that express the receptor for this virus to bind to, so it's possible for it to infect kidney cells, doesn't mean that it's getting directly to your kidneys, right? It still has to get there, it has to get into your bloodstream and then get to your kidneys. And for some people, that won't happen. Their body will have cleared the infection before that happens. So that may be one thing that differentiates why some people have a severe illness and some people don't, is that some people may just have a respiratory infection and their immune system and their body is able to clear that infection while it's still in the respiratory tract. And that's all they'll ever experience. And some people, it may actually get into the bloodstream and circulate within their body and thus able to get to other organs and other parts of the body and have more systemic effects. You know, that's still an open question, you know, and that's one of the things that's a little tricky to study. We can potentially draw people's blood and look for the virus there, but you know, you can't necessarily test a living person to see if their, you know, kidneys are infected. That's a tricky proposition. But we can see that some people are having kidney problems, as a secondary consequence of this infection. So seeing people with symptoms related to the cardiovascular system, their heart and their blood vessels and things. We're seeing people with neurological symptoms, starting from loss of the sense of smell is apparently being reported.
Yeah, that strikes me as odd. Like, and it also kind of makes me wonder if that's something that you would necessarily think about, right? Like, I could just imagine if it comes along slowly, you might not even realize that I'm not really.
Yeah, I mean, I would. Yeah, so that's not something you can rely on. It's like, oh, now I know I have the coronavirus because I can't smell. But it's something that they're finding and patients are reporting. once they've been diagnosed and, you know, had shown other more common symptoms.
Is that similar to, you know, we know we've gone through, you know, bad colds, and, like, allergies where, like, you don't really smell or taste food while you're going through. Is that, like, similar to that, or is this a different?
Yeah, my understanding is that this is different, and that it's being reported in the medical literature because it is more unusual. But I think the last I looked at, there were still some open questions as to what exactly that is. Is the virus directly infecting the nerve cells that mediate your sense of smell to your brain? Is it just because of, other infection in the nose, and then it's sort of, as a secondary effect, the immune response or something else is disrupting the sense of smell? Those are kinds of open questions. The same thing with some of these other things. You know, with people that are having kidney and heart problems and so forth, is that because the virus is directly infecting those organs and tissues, or is it just because their body is having a serious illness and a serious immune response, and so parts of their body, like their kidneys, that maybe were already not working optimally in ways that maybe that person did or didn't know about, once this kind of puts extra stress on their body, that gets exacerbated. And so that's why they're having those kidney symptoms. You know, an immune response, especially an immune response to something like this, when you're having a fever and so forth, even though it starts out localized, the signals that tell your body to start ramping up the immune response, they're called cytokines, they can spread through your bloodstream and they can spread to different parts of your body. And so you can sort of have a whole body-wide reaction to certain things. And so just even if the infection isn't necessarily in your kidneys may be feeling the effects of your body responding to an infection. So they're still studying that, still some open questions, but it does seem like one of the reasons why there are such severe outcomes is that the virus can have impacts on various different parts of your body, possibly directly. And that's, you know, a little bit different than like a common cold that really can only infect the cells of your upper respiratory tract and never gets down deeper into your lungs. That's what, you know, even before we talk about your kidneys and your heart and so forth, one of the things that is more difficult about this infection and why you start getting that like difficulty breathing and shortness of breath and more than just coughing and sneezing and a runny nose is that it's not just an upper respiratory infection, which is generally like your nose and throat, but it's actually getting down into people's lungs and causing things like pneumonia and respiratory distress. And so that is, that seems more clearly that it has the ability to, because it has the ability to directly infect your lung cells. And that's where that problem, those problems are coming from. And so, yeah, so that's part of why there's a wide range and why this is a different thing than just a common cold.
So I know that they've talked, I've heard little bits about them talking about the cytokine storm. I think that's what you were saying, the cytokines. What are those, and what is the storm?
Yeah, so cytokines are different molecules that your immune system uses to communicate with the different cells in the immune system to regulate how it's responding to something. So we talked, for example, about in order to make antibodies, a B cell has to both bind to the thing that it recognizes and get a signal from a T cell, a helper T cell, that says, oh yes, I've also seen that same thing, it's time to respond. And the way that the T cell communicates to the B cell that it's time to respond is by making these molecules called cytokines that the B cell then takes in. It has receptors on the outside of the B cell that bind to those cytokines and take them in and say, okay, now I have to respond. Or something changes on the inside of the B cell because of the binding on the outside. Then it changes the expression of proteins inside the B cell and starts to divide and so forth. So the cytokines are how your body responds. And there are cytokines that are positive regulating. So they say have more of an immune response. You know, the basic message is have more of an immune response. And there are cytokines that the basic message is have less of an immune response. It's time to ramp down, because that's just as important a part of immune response is recognizing that we're not seeing that virus so much anymore. It's time to ramp it down. Because if your body was always acting as if it was infected, that would have long-term health consequences. So you want your immune system to come down again. And unfortunately, it seems like in some cases, that's not happening for patients. So that instead of having a balance of positive and negative regulation, they get into a positive feedback loop where there are cytokines that are saying ramp up the immune response, which is causing more cytokines to be made that say have more of an immune response, and it just keeps growing and growing. And that's what they're referring to as a cytokine storm, where it just, your body gets overwhelmed with these positive signals that say have more and more and more of an immune response, which in itself can start to have consequences because of inflammation and other things, that these immune system cells are going into different tissues and parts of your body and having different reactions. And that can cause organ problems and disease in and of itself.
Well, so now this makes me wonder, because we have a personal connection with this. When our daughter was 4, she had Kawasaki's disease, which how the doctors kind of described it to me, which you've probably read a little bit more about it, but how they kind of described it to me is that a virus entered her system and her immune system responded to it, got rid of the virus, but her immune system didn't stop, and that we saw all of these potential damages with her immune system that kept, you know, it kept attacking her, you know, so there was risk for her heart and for, you know, her blood vessels and all of this stuff, because, you know, and like I said, how they described it was that it was, you know, her immune system just hadn't figured out that it needed to stop. So to me, it sounds very similar to that.
Yeah, it's a related problem that she was having an autoimmune response to her own cardiovascular system that was, as far as we know, and we, you know, they don't know the specific infection, but the general understanding is that, or the model is that some infection triggers an immune response that then doesn't shut down properly, and that's what manifests as that auto, then turns into an autoimmune response to your body's own proteins and cells in the cardiovascular system.
But this isn't an autoimmune response.
It doesn't seem to be, although I don't know how much they looked for that. But certainly, you know, there's obviously an infection that's being responded to. It may transition if it goes on long enough. I suppose that's one possible scenario, one possible reason why some of these things are so severe, why there's some patients are experiencing damage to their lungs that even after they've cleared the infection, it, you know, isn't necessarily healed or it may have long-term consequences. But yeah, it may simply just be that the virus is overwhelming the system, and so the immune response to the immune system seems to think that it needs to keep escalating its response. So it's definitely a similar problem. It may not be exactly the same kind of autoimmune scenario.
I think we've covered a lot of information. Maybe this is a good time to kind of wrap up and think about what we're going to talk about next week.
Sure. If you have something you'd like to talk about, maybe you'd like us to talk about something other than the coronavirus for a change. We'd be happy to do that too. What do people need to know? You can let us know at BioBreakPod on Twitter, or biobreakpod@gmail.com. And you can find
us also on Facebook, but I don't know what it is. And I run the Facebook page.
Yeah, Facebook doesn't provide as easy URLs, but certainly search, if you search BioBreak and look for the little green logo, that should be us. And we look forward to chatting with you next week. In the meantime, make sure you wash your hands and
don't touch your face.
Sorry, I'm back again. Just wanted to point out that in the flow of conversation, I overlooked that in some cases it is important to do blood type matching to when giving serum or plasma treatments for things like the coronavirus, especially when that plasma comes from a single donor. You want to make sure that the blood type is matched between the donor and the recipient for the least chance of adverse outcomes, possibly because the plasma might contain antibodies that might react against the recipient's blood, for example. And so that is actually, the blood type matching is actually a consideration in some instances with those treatments. And so I want to make sure that we clarified that. Anyway, thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next time. DNA, you're in my heart.